Okay, hi, I'm Jill from Jill Trebilcock Live, and welcome to the fourth in a series of very special shows produced by Stephen Roberts from Stephen Roberts Live and April Rain's We Raw Radio. I first discovered today's brilliant guest, a true Renaissance man, Professor Stuart Twemlow, whilst researching teachers who bullied students. Stuart Twemlow is a psychoanalyst and a psychiatrist who's worked for 40 years in communities researching and managing the causes of violence and ways to promote peace in consultation with schools, cities, corporations, the FBI and governments in third world countries. Stuart is on the teaching faculty of the Houston, Texas Center for Psychoanalytic Studies. He retired in 2011 from working as senior psychiatrist Menninger Clinic and Professor Menninger Department of Psychiatry, Baylor College Medicine, Houston, Texas. Stuart is visiting Professor University College London, member American College of Psychiatrists and Distinguished Life Fellow of the American Psychiatric Association. He's a founding member, he's the founding editor of the International Journal of Applied Psychoanalytic Studies, and he has written over 200 articles, books, and book chapters. In 2012, Stuart Twemlow received the Sigourney Award for contributions to psychoanalysis. Dr. Twemlow is active in sponsoring educational programs and establishing community-based psychoanalysis within the International and American Psychoanalytic Associations. Many of his ideas are derived from a lifelong study of practice of the martial arts and meditative arts. He is, in fact, a seventh degree black belt and master teacher, a Renshi, in Kenpo Karate and Kabuto weapons, a student of Zen, and an exhibited black ink brush painter. Welcome, Professor Professor Twemlow. Thank you for coming. I'm sorry I keep getting my words waddled.
That's okay, Joel. Don't worry. It's a pleasure to be with the both of you.
You're so good to us. You're so good to me. Thank you so much. So today we were going to discuss altruism, which is one of my favourite subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know why you think it's so fantastic.
Yeah, and as an analyst, of course, it's not typical of what analysts want or study. Very few papers have been written by analysts on altruism. However, there's a huge literature on it, starting back with the invention of the term altruism in the 1600s by a philosopher, Comte. And since then, many philosophers have written book after book on altruism. Interesting. A number of psychologists have. One or two have tried to characterize it psychologically. But these are minimal compared with the number of philosophical writings on the topic. Now, within psychology today, the field itself is at an interesting turning point. As a field, psychology, and I here include psychiatry, psychology as a general field, is relatively unsuccessful in helping people solve their problems. I say that with qualifications in that area. It's certainly compared with medicine in general, and specifically areas like surgery and so on. What it can do is ameliorate some conditions, but only if the patient gets attracted to the idea of it. And how to attract somebody to the idea of being healthy rather than sick is infinitely harder to do than one might think. You might think, for example, if I said to you, I could cure all of your problems overnight, all you have to do is follow a formula, you'd say, of course I will do that. The trouble is, one, you wouldn't. You may do it for a day or two. Or number two, you'd start doing it, it was too hard to do. Or number three, you'd start doing it, you'd say, well, this is ridiculous. I could do this anyway. Like telling an alcoholic to stop drinking. Well, what's the problem with drinking? Why don't you just stop? Now, when you bring up altruism as a entity that is not philosophical, that's part of practical work that everybody does, it adopts or it graces itself with a role that is far beyond simply positive thinking or helping your neighbor at a certain point.
How's that?
My feeling, and I'm not in the majority here, there's a group of us who believe that altruism is like an instinct. It's like a fundamental drive, like sexuality and aggression. And we are in the middle of trying to push the idea that far from being an ego function, which is the way many analysts see it, i.e. a way people have of defending themselves against something, and come back to that later, we feel it's as fundamental a drive as sexuality or aggression, and it's shared by all primates.
Mm.
So time and time again, you'll find whales keeping a sick whale on the surface by using their noses and wringing the whale so it can breathe. One of the most moral of all animals is the wolf, contrary to what you think from horror stories. I don't think there's been a single killing of a human being by a wolf on the North American continent ever. They're animals that are seen as much more ferocious and much more bestial than they actually are. They're very moral. So if you, for example, are fighting a wolf and you expose the side of your neck to the wolf, which means kill me, the wolf will back off and not kill you.
Mm.
It's a sign that you've submitted and there's no further purpose in continuing that sort of fighting. So here's the thing that's complicated. I'm getting around to it in a minute or two. In animals that have small brains but have been used as human models, like chimpanzees, orangutans, and a variety of similar monkey-style animals that have been studied in depth in zoo conditions. What you'll find is that when the alpha male monkeys fight over things like who leads the group, they fight to a certain point. Blood will be let, quite serious injury, but at a certain point, nobody used to understand, they'll stop fighting, start grooming each other, which is patting them on the head and kissing each other and licking the wounds. And one worker found this was when the senior grandmother monkey indicated the fight was over, i.e. there was no need to fight anymore, the winner had been decided. So there's a lot of fighting of the primitive type that goes on around who leads, but it has a function. Now, as the brain gets bigger and bigger, finishes in human beings with the largest of all brains, you get all sorts of perversity. Human beings are capable not only of fighting well beyond the time necessary to resolve a problem, and they'll fight to the death, they'll fight because they gain pleasure from inflicting pain, called sadism. And there are one or two animals that are like that. Oddly enough, the dove is one of them. And ironically, we've chosen the dove as a symbol of peace. That's quite a nasty bird. And the deer is another animal that is far from Bambi. The deers can be quite cruel to their own young. But the majority of animals will back off at the point the problem needs no longer fighting, except for human beings. And where the Menninger Clinic I used to work was previously located, which was in a very small town in Kansas, at the zoo there was a sign that said, around the corner, is the most vicious of all animals. And around the corner you would go and you'd be looking at a mirror for the reflection of yourself. And there is the most vicious of all animals is the human being. The only animal that continuously and regularly hurts others for pleasure. So now we began to think sexuality and aggression is okay, but what is it that the primates do when they take care of each other? Like the whales I just mentioned. I mean, you could look for 100,000 examples. Then we began to think maybe in the human condition there is an untapped stimulus to do good that has been overwhelmed by the sadism of our life, by the cruelty of our life, and by the horrors of starvation and disease and the abuse of children and things like that, where you sort of get into a habit of thinking that's in no way altruistic. And so we propose that if you promote altruism in young children, we work from pre-K through the fifth grade. That would be year four, I think, or year five, four or five in the Australian system. And we used altruism as a primary uniting agent, so that a child who did good for others, who helped another child, let's say with bullying, or took care of a child who was sick by taking their homework home or going to visit them to make sure they were up to date, or spontaneously offered themselves for the good of others rather than themselves, without having to be asked or without getting an award for it, we gave them special rewards. And then we encouraged all children to applaud altruism. And little by little, the bullies lost power. They didn't get reward for being a chest-beating macho who likes to hurt people. That had no social capital, if you want to call it that way. It didn't get you anything in the social system. It got you ignored. So many bullies turned into altruistic, what we call upstanders. They preferred having friends and being good to people, and they said that. I mean, I'd rather be this than a bully because you can't buy friends. So throughout the system, the altruistic action reinforces itself. And
yes,
the tough guys, the chest-beating gorillas, find that they're no less of a man. If you want to get a touch of psychoanalysis in it, I think American men have a terrifying fear of castration, as Freud called it. Not castration in the sense of anybody would slice off your genitalia.
Yeah.
But castration in the sense that you would be rendered amasculine. You would be rendered a wuss, a sook. And everybody would laugh at you because you were a church boy and you were so good at everything you did and you went to Sunday school all the time. And in other words, you would be seen, if you were altruistic, as weak, unmanly. So we managed to turn around quite a number of schools so that the social capital came for being gentle and kind and altruistic, and no social capital for being nasty and unpleasant and bullying. So then we moved, probably about the mid-2000s, into trying to put this into operation in cities with the idea that if men became more aware that altruism was not weak, was not something only women did, was not something associated necessarily with religion, although many of the icons of altruism have been religious, like Mother Teresa of Calcutta and Mahatma Gandhi and so on and so forth, that these are simply practical ways that if you practice them, your life will be better, and not only that. Some recent research has shown that your physical body will be healthier. Mm-hmm. Your blood coagulation's better, your immune system, which is really... I'm sure you both have noticed that there's an enormous amount of research going on and what affects the immune system. But one of the things we know about it is your mood does. And if your mood is high and you're feeling like you are a valuable member of the community and you're appreciated, you're far less likely to get yourself into trouble. An interesting study that I read the other day showed that if you are a person who thinks positively, you're likely to get only one-fifth of the number of colds that a person who thinks negatively will get. In other words, a negative thinking person will get five times more head colds than you will. We're talking about physical here. This isn't just self-reported psychology.
Now, can I just draw on another bit of information that you have, Stuart, in terms of Chinese understanding? Do you use the concept of the word Wei Qi, the protective Qi on the outside of the body?
Yeah.
So I'm wondering how that relates to Wei Qi, too, from an Eastern perspective.
Yeah. You know, I follow that reasoning, and I see it as sensible in the way it explains things.
Mm.
But the link between Eastern mystical thinking that surrounds balance, which I think is a sort of universal value of Eastern thinking, mm-hmm. and the idea of flow, energy flow.
Mm.
That energy, I think, is the same energy as what Freud calls psychic energy. And I think
yes.
the Chinese call it qi and the Japanese call it ki.
Mm.
And Freud saw it as a metaphor. But the Chinese and the Japanese and the Koreans don't see it as a metaphor. They see it as an actual thing. A measurable thing.
Mm.
Connection between those two ends of the spectrum has not yet been made. There are attempts going on. I've actually just reviewed a paper written by a Chinese philosopher that attempts to begin to bring those concepts together. So I don't find it useful in day-to-day work, but
mm.
what I find is it's easy to explain things that way. Now, here's the problem. I don't want to get too obscure for you, but philosophically, it's easy to explain something with what people call radiation theories, which is the way this change occurs is because energy flows from this place to this place. So those theories abound in Western parapsychology under the heading of theosophy. There are many, many theories that are radiation theories where astral energy flows from here to there and changes things. To philosophers, that's just too easy. Things are not that simple. And they aren't that simple.
Mm.
Now, does that mean that Eastern philosophies like the concept of qi, or one perhaps better example is acupuncture, that they actually work? Of course they work. I mean, there's no doubt about it. They work.
Mm.
The question of how they work is unanswered.
Mm. Yeah, that's very true. And a lot, well, one of the theories that they have, and I think some Russians have taken some photographs of them now, some Curlian photographs or whatever they call them, that, you know, we do have magnetic fields running through our body. And that's sort of, yeah. And that each one, like it's the five elemental points that have the different actions, are located in different parts of the body, so you can sort of tap into them.
And you can change. You can change people. Just to not come down on the side of one or the other, let me tell you of another fascinating paper that I heard broadcast on PBS yesterday.
Mm.
There's a center studying the placebo effect,
mm-hmm.
that effect. Where, so for any drug you take, about 30% of the value of the drug is placebo. In other mm-hmm. words, eating a sugar pill would produce the same effect with no agent in it at all. Just somebody who says, this is the pill that's going to cure you. Now, in a study with migraine headaches, they found that 55% of the impact of the very active, very good, proven drug to cure an acute migraine headache was due to placebo. So, for example,
interesting.
Yeah, if you had a pill that said on it the drug's name, highly effective, it would cure the person.
Mm.
And if you put a placebo in that same packet and said, drug, highly effective, it also has a very good effect on that person. Just
well,
like
well, as a medical
drug.
Yeah, well, as a medical doctor, one of the main points that you use to cure a migraine in acupuncture is the point on the top of the head, GV20. And that actually causes the vessels to dilate. So I'm wondering if relaxation from breathing, oh, this is highly effective, would cause a diastole, cause you to sort of relax, and then that would cure the headache.
Indeed. And, you know, what I'm saying is that Eastern ways of speaking about it and Western ways of speaking about it now are at a point where there isn't any doubt about the outcome. The headache gets better. The person gets better. As one he said, Stuart, he was the most conservative Republican you can ever imagine, and also a surgeon. I said, what do you think of acupuncture, Jim? And he said, well, I went to China and I watched a child, 5-year-old, have its tonsils out. And you know what? The only anesthetic was a neat needle in its shoulder. He said, that's sort of impressive.
That's very impressive.
A guy like that says, my God, how did that happen?
Yeah.
So we're not arguing about outcomes.
No.
We're arguing about how it actually happens.
Yeah, well, that was the theory I just put forward then, is that relaxation. That's why I'm asking you as a medico, does that relaxation...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But you see, I mean, relaxation sounds fascinatingly easy to understand, but what if I were to tell you that a marathon runner at 15 miles was completely relaxed, running at about 15 to 20 miles an hour?
Well, I would be very open to the idea.
Even though every muscle in his body was running.
I have run once when I was young and fit. I remember being able to run effortlessly. So I really get that. That makes sense, yeah.
Relaxation is not just lying floppy with your muscles not making any tension. Relaxation is a state of mind.
Yeah. And so that also affects the vessels, and they open up and stop the pressure that would cause the headache.
And you yourself can do that. I call it a third wind, where you settle into a rhythm and you're fully relaxed, even though your muscles are extremely tense and working very hard. So all I'm trying to say is relaxation is not just relaxing and going to sleep and letting yourself get floppy. It's complicated.
So when you're Grandpa Rambo, you can be quite relaxed.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
And the best stuff I've ever done in a gym, by the way, is when I am relaxed and not worrying about doing it. Then people say, how did you do that? And then I stop doing it right away.
All right, let's go back to altruism. So where were you going before I decided that you were talking about the protective chi? I was thinking how what you were saying about, you know, how your immune system is really strong, and I was thinking because you have so much sort of Eastern information as well, I thought I'd explore it a little bit. But so we were really saying how protective altruism is, and while I've got a chance to speak, I was thinking how incredibly I actually believe, as a meditator, when I have been in my deepest meditation, or when I have come out of my deepest meditation, I do have enormous altruism, like compassion. So I really, and when, you know, I'm not thinking and I'm deep in my heart, I really do know when I start to think about it, but the feeling is exquisite compassion. So I actually believe it is what people are talking about when they're talking about God or being love, you know, or not the, you know, I'm an atheist, obviously, as a Buddhist, but whatever that means, because I can call that God from a Christian point of view.
Exactly. And the point about these sort of states are like anthropologists call apotheosis. It's like you die in the body to be reborn in the spirit, enlightened. And what you see is that everything is really the same. And differences are just technical conveniences that come out of perceptional needs, the convenience of the moment. And you know that to a point where it doesn't need to be a belief system anymore. It's known to you.
Yes.
You're in that state, and you can capture it beyond just the meditative state. I think enlightened people are in that state all the time. They finally see it. People like us, I've had the same experience meditating. I've meditated for as many decades. But I remember that feeling of absolute extraordinary peace and love of all. Not just people, things, even my enemies. And the realization of that was just emotionally overwhelming. But after a while, when the tears settle down and when the love is no longer as intense, you're in a state of mind where the world cannot undo you.
Yeah.
You come to a point of being at home in yourself. Finally, I'm at home in myself. I know. And then you do what I just did then, you laugh. And it's so funny because it's so obvious, and you say, why didn't I see that before? I mean, this is nothing new. I am who I am.
And it's altruistic.
Being a good person, and I can give all I have, and it doesn't make me less whole and less in myself. I could give everything I had away, and I would still be myself. So you don't identify yourself by material objects. That's compassion, I think. And that's why people who are enlightened, like Gandhi and so on, can give away. The only thing he couldn't give away was his goat, which, by the way, cost the Indian government thousands of rupees to keep alive. It was a very unhealthy goat. So a lot of people thought that he really needed that goat. He really had nothing. He had his prayer bowl and his sandals and something to cover his body. And you see, I think that is enlightenment. You've touched onto it. I think meditative practice would be amazingly useful to the clinical community, those who practice psychotherapy. And oddly enough, the American Psychiatric has now had several keynote addresses on the role of meditation in helping people recover from psychiatric difficulties. And some of the same old guys that were famous in the 70s are now limping on stage talking about what they talked about then. So that cycle is coming back, I think, with value, because there's also a lot of brain studies on meditation that show that a meditator's brain does not operate like an ordinary person's brain. There are certain ways the midbrain particularly operates that are different. And stress is handled very differently. And here's what happens in a meditator. And tell me if I'm getting off track here, by the way.
Well, it's all one, because I'd like to just define it before you go there and see if you'll agree that we were talking about altruism as being a drive, and right. I'm saying I agree with you. It's like an innate state, and so if we actually, there's many ways in which we can sort of contact our altruism, and one is almost like fake it till you make it, in a way, in as much as if we're training children in altruism, then we're setting up the conditions for the natural altruism to arise.
I agree. And meditative practice, getting down to the nitty-gritty, is one of the best ways to train people in altruism.
And so you were going to take that in. Yeah, exactly. So now you're going to take that into the brain study. Is that what you're about to say?
Yeah.
Go.
Well, I could give you a very practical example of the difference between a meditator and a non-meditator. The experiment is the following. Somebody comes into a room where the subject is hooked up to polygraphs that measure heart rate, skin resistance, brain feedback, a variety of physiological measures. And the subject of the experiment knows that somebody's going to come into the room and prick them with a needle on the back of their hand. And then they're going to leave. And there's a possibility they might come back, but the subject is told we don't know if they're going to come back or not. But again, it's only once. So you can only be pricked twice at the most. Now, if you take a non-meditator and you take their heart rate, as soon as the person comes into the room, their heart rate goes way up. And as they walk towards you with the needle, that heart rate stays very high. And then when you get the prick, it goes even higher in a big spike when you get the pain. And then when you leave the room, that heart rate stays very, very high for a long period of time as the person is anticipating that you might return. Now, if you're a meditator, the pricker comes into the room, the heart rate remains exactly the same. And then, when he pricks you, there's a big rise in heart rate from the pain. And right as soon as it's spiked up, back it goes to the baseline. And long before the person who pricked you leaves the room, it's right as it was before they came in. In other words, the meditator can respond to reality as reality only and does not have to put future into it. They just are there. Now, that sort of being is healthy.
Or hang on to the past.
They don't hang on to anything, past or future. They just there.
There you go. Pain. Keep going.
So, you know, in my opinion, people trained that way will be better at almost anything they do. And my children, I have a 43-year-old son who's an academic. He still meditates on a regular basis using a sound that he learned when he was 6 years old. And I said, "Don't you want another sound?" He said, "No, this works." He's still using it. So, yeah, that's what I would recommend people do. Now, why isn't the whole population meditating? Because it's boring, Jill. I mean, it's easy to teach meditation. It's very easy to learn. It's extremely hard to do. And 99.9% of people start off with enthusiasm and then they say, "Oh, come on, it's got to be more interesting than this." Teacher and say, "Can I change it? Can I add something to make it more interesting?" No. How can I change it? Only if you feel it's harming you. If it's harming you, change it. Otherwise, the boredom is part of the learning. Life is boring, right?
Yeah. But it's also very peaceful. You know, a peace is nice. It is a very comfortable feeling, and that's where we're getting back to that altruistic sort of feeling.
You want to put up that picture now?
Are you there, Steve? I think we lost Steve. He's probably in Samadhi.
Well, if Steve comes back, let's have him put up that picture, because I want to finish this by bringing us back to how you use altruism to deal with problems in communities, which is one of our major themes here. Theoretically, and then we've talked about it practically from the point of view of how does an individual learn to be altruistic. Now I want to put it into the large-scale city and community context, if we can get Steve back.
Are you back yet, Steve? I'm trying to send him messages. I don't know. I can make lots of noises by sending him lots of pictures. You can keep talking for a minute, Stuart, while I try and get him back. Talking about altruism as being innate, I mean, like, we wouldn't actually exist without altruism.
You wouldn't actually what?
We'd have eaten our children if we didn't have altruism, you know, I mean, like, so altruism in a way really rules the world.
It does. And a camp. Now, there are some classic cases that are problematic, like the Kitty Genovese case in 67, where this is a woman who was being stabbed to death in an apartment complex, and lots of people watched it, but nobody called 911 or contacted the police. So she eventually died. Now, that's an example of the bystander phenomenon, where nobody helps. that I want to get involved. However, the case was misreported very, very badly.
What do you mean it was misreported?
It was simply not what happened. The New York Times reporters made a name for themselves out of it, but in reality, number one, there was no 911 in those days. Didn't exist.
Right.
Number two, several people went directly to help. Number three, several other people went down to the police station and got police.
Oh.
So it was purely a piece of misreporting. However, that phenomenon is one of the most repeatable sociological phenomena there are. It's true. That's what does happen in many emergencies. So, for example, if you stage a heart attack on a busy city street, within 6 minutes, 95% of the surrounding people will have stopped to help you. Now, if people see that an ambulance is there, nobody will stop. In other words, people won't stop if they have a moment to think that they may have to give a report to the police, they may have to come to court, they may have to do a whole lot of things. Another example would be if a child falls into the water from a wall. There's a whole ton of people there, some of whom can't swim. You'll find them all in the water. Then they'll suddenly say, why am I in the water? I can't even swim. I'm there to save the baby. Without thinking.
Yeah.
Somebody said, just a minute, I can't swim.
Yeah.
They don't jump in the water.
Yeah.
Altruism is that innate. It comes out of you as long as your brain doesn't get in the way of it.
Yes, I do think it's innate. And you were saying things before that really related it to making, in terms of bullying and status, and making altruism have social currency and being a high status thing. And so that's a matter of just changing the what gives status in our society or in our community.
Yeah, and we've tried to do it in schools. That's what I've been doing mostly because, you know, they're a captive population.
Yes, exactly. That's what I call them.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But we've now about to move into the larger scale communities based on a couple of experiments, one done in Montego Bay, Jamaica, and the other done in Topeka, Kansas. Both of these interventions were with cities, and they depended on fostering altruism in the leaders.
Yes. Yes.
And the interventions were not based on dealing with a particular problem, but was based on the idea that within a community there are four what we call community stabilizing systems.
Yes.
They have to be there and have to be interactive. They have
what
to
are they?
Get along with each other. Education, in its broader sense, down to any education you get after you've grown up. Law and order, which include police, prisons, and military. Health, which includes all health, including preventive care. And spirituality. Now, the way spirituality is defined as a stabilizing system has nothing to do with religion or God. Spirituality is defined as the desire to be or the act of being altruistic. Many altruistic people are atheists. Many of them.
Mm-hmm.
So these are considered by us to be the four systems that generally do nothing but fight each other over budgets. They don't know each other at all. And so what we did in these situations was we got the primary leaders of these four systems talk to each other as people and to get to know each other. We started meeting, for example, in the law enforcement center, and the police representative had his gun and his badge and all his suit on, and everybody was formal, and we sat around a table and we met in City Hall. But after about 6 months, it was somebody's house we were meeting in, and then little by little, the policeman came in jeans and a shirt, and he left his gun and suit behind. And then we all got on first name terms and started babysitting, running out for movies together. We became friends.
Fantastic.
And things started working.
Yeah. Stephen has put the diagram up. Can you see the diagram? But it is up for the people.
Oh, it is. Good.
So you might have to bring up your own diagram, but it will be up on the podcast if you want to speak from it.
Now, let me just say, in the middle there, you'll see child and family. The center of any community is the family. That's why you have a community. if you're a hermit, you don't have a community. You don't want to see, you know, everybody together. If you elect to live together, there are certain sacrifices you have to make. And to work together, these are the sacrifices. If you go out from there, you'll find the four community stabilizing systems. I think it's written. And you'll find pieces of it that show some of the various functions of the stabilizing systems, way beyond just police or just teachers. They have to do with the philosophy of education in a community, a philosophy needing law and order. You have to give up, for example, the wish to take anybody's property that you like. You have to be willing to give up the fact that you can't steal other people's property.
No, that's not fair.
And it's not fair, but you've got to do it. And so on and so on. And then surrounding that, you have the links.
I'm looking at it too.
Yeah.
I've got it up on my screen. Yeah. So
the links within the community that help them, and particularly they involve newspapers, television, and the internet. In the time we did this work was in the 1970s and 80s. It was primarily newspapers who had an immense impact on stereotyping, particularly government officials.
Yes.
And the newspapers made huge differences. We first worked with the mayor and city council that were non-functional. And they ground to a halt after losing a $9 million HUD grant, which is a low-cost, low-income housing grant, arguing about where to place a $75 compulsory stop sign. They'd missed the due date. So they realized there was a problem in the community. We got them going, and without spending a huge amount of time on it, I had this idea that there was something missing from this whole thing. The way the community was organized was mayor and city council. In the United States, you have an alternative government, which is village manager and trustees. But this was the more traditional mayor city council government. So I took each member of the city council and the mayor out to lunch, and I got their individual viewpoints. And I found their individual viewpoints almost identical. Each thought the other was what the other thought they were.
Transference. I do it all the time. It's my favorite pastime.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So what I decided to do was, I got them all together, and we also had a very weird religious cult, because we found out you can't have a private meeting of a city council. And
without a religious cult, what do you mean?
Anybody's supposed to be able to come into a public meeting. They can't have private.
Oh, right.
So yeah. this religious cult decided to come. So they were sitting over one side, and the city council were over there. And essentially what I did, I asked each member of the city council to say, and I gave them 10 minutes, why they'd become a member of the city council. Because I found out they got very little money and a huge amount of work. Huge amount of work.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, there's got to be some reason these people do this, other than criticism, which most of them got. And sure enough, I mean, there were people crying in the room over the idealism of these people. The most hated member of the city council turned out to be the man who devoted his life to the care of children, and nobody knew it.
Wow.
And the religious cult also got into it. The minister made his play about why he'd become a minister and why this had been done. And in the parking lot after the meeting, everybody was hugging. And they all became friends. So the whole atmosphere of the city council and mayor changed completely. I mean, there was no further treatment. That's all it was.
That was the treatment.
I call this subjectification of the object. The
object. Subjectification, yep.
The object.
Explain.
The object becomes a subject. The thing becomes a person.
Yes.
And I just want to finish
No, we've got time. We've still got 15 minutes. So that's what Stephen just sent me, and I just want to bring it back to what I'm really interested in is when you do want to finish. So say what you want to finish, and then I'll tell you what I'm interested in.
Well, all I was going to say was there's an even better example of using altruism and self-understanding and subjectification of the object, and that's the solution in 1998 of the Problems in Ireland. Those problems, which have recurred over hundreds of years in Ireland, were solved by the Good Friday Accord, it was called. I don't know if you've heard that in Australia. Bill Clinton had something to do with it, and several people did. But one of our collaborators, his name is John Alderdice. I think he was made a baronet, so he's Lord Alderdice. He was one of them.
I actually went to his lecture, remember, with you.
He came out.
You were there.
Yeah, we got him out. Yeah. We thought he might be helpful with the Australian Aboriginal problem.
Yeah, he's proven. Cassie are very keen on him. They keep posting stories on him and his Aboriginal connection.
He has a relative who's an Aboriginal, so he falls into the Aboriginal section. Now, he was one of the main architects of that accord, and essentially it was psychoanalytic. And what happened was the group were asked to remain working until the problem was solved. And they had to meet. They met 2 or 3 hours, 3 times a week, over a period of years. They got to know each other as people. And so you're babysitting your enemy's friends, and you're going to golf with him, and you're going to a movie or taking him out to dinner. Whether he's a member of the IRA or the Sinn Féin or the Protestants or the Catholics, it really doesn't matter very much because he's a person.
That's right. This is a bit of an insinuation of me into this, but it really reminds me of this. When I first understood or thought about agape in that sense, I wrote this really crazy little poem that said, My demons dance, they scream and shout, they nip at my heels as they tear me about. Ulysses on his journey. The trials of Hercules are not a fable, but Psyche's journey to make us able to welcome our enemy at our table. Agape, the ancient wisdom.
Yeah, very nice. Yeah. And that's it. Welcome your enemy at your table.
Yeah, they really have to do that. And that's what you're doing here. And this is why we keep going back to grassroots. And I look at the center of the diagram and it goes children, family, friends, children, family, friends. And this, you know, this bottom-up sort of connection that we keep doing. And this radio that we're involved in here, this station we're on right now, Council the Cabal, I often think, I wonder if they wonder why I think it's so important and why Stephen thinks it's so important for us to bring a psychiatrist in and a community analyst in, you know, with a psychoanalytical approach to the community when they're just saying, look, well, they're not just saying, they're saying they've taken away our Bill of Rights there, you know, they're doing all these, you know, everything's wrong. And I'm going, yeah, but we need solutions focused. And the only solution I can ever come up with is it has to start locally in terms of community connection.
Yeah.
And have an uprising with the strengthening of the power. And even, you know, like they're just so scared of the government, and rightly so, all the terrible things that the government are doing. And, like, how do you do it? But you can't just, it's like, you know, I keep saying there's four truths. There's suffering, the cause of suffering, but there's also cessation of suffering and the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And we really have to focus on the whole four. And so, you know, your little mandala here of with newspapers and media and internet and all these sort of interconnection.
You know, it's funny you use the word mandala. Quite of my knowledge of that, so I never thought of that a diagram, which I've used hundreds of times.
Mm.
Mandala, but it is a mandala.
It is a mandala.
Yes, yeah.
A community development mandala. Yeah, I've never called it that before either, but there it came out.
I think I'm going to call it that. It's what
okay,
it
is. Good idea.
It's got a spiritual piece to it that encourages people's absorption into an overall concept which will make them more compassionate and more altruistic and happier.
Yes.
We did and this with all these people. We got them all to help each other out. For example, one of the most striking things that I remember was the police chief who decided he would represent the police department and the military and prisons. We gave him the job of helping ministers fill their pews in church on Sunday. What more obviously nothing to do with police work. And that's, of course, what he said. What the hell?
It was the policeman's job to fill the minister's pews.
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, I think that should be against the law.
So here we, and each person had something not in their area of expertise. That was the whole.
Yes.
They got to work together, and in working out things, the policeman came up with certain interesting ideas about how to get people to come to church.
Yes.
The minister had not thought of. He just sort of took it for granted because he was a God-fearing man. And that happened all the way along. So each one began to see what the other's primary task was, which we felt was essential to become a good community leader.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's exactly it. Like in the tantras, you know, when you just to tell a few secrets to the world, you actually enter, you know, through the different doors of the mandala and the different rooms of the mandala, because the mandala is actually representative of, you know, all aspects of our consciousness. So what you're saying is you got the policeman to enter the mandala, the room of the mandala of the... Yeah, and that's what you must do in psychoanalysis too. How do you do that a bit?
Here's what you have to do, and it may take years.
Yeah.
You have to be willing to jump in with the patient to the depths of their most primitive agony.
Yeah.
You have to be willing to go there.
Mm.
You have to be willing to feel crazy.
Yeah.
Like you can't stand it anymore.
That's really hard. I find that sometimes. Yeah.
Very, very, very exhausting.
Mm.
If you don't go there, the patient will not get any better.
Because you don't meet them where they are.
Because you're scared of them.
Yeah.
You are telling them what you'd like them to be and what they say what they want to be, and then you won't do it.
I won't go to join them. I won't join with them. I won't understand. I don't stand under.
If you don't stand under it. You don't face the devil.
Yeah.
Look him in the eye and say, okay, here we are.
Because I got this friend that when I talk to him, I absolutely, like, my whole body just goes, you know, he's so crazy. And I just want to say, stop that, you're making me feel crazy. Like, but in fact, as a psychoanalyst, you just have to go, okay, I'll just stay here and be crazy with you.
You do just that. And you know, one of the things about being behind the couch is you can wiggle around and you can cry if you need to. And you can fiddle or do drawings or, you know, silly.
That's what I do. I do cry.
It's hard to do that if somebody's looking at you, although, you know, that will happen. There's nothing wrong with crying in front of a patient, but behind the couch gives you a little more freedom to be expressive. And if you're... Which, when you're like that, you'll be very physically uncomfortable. So you need to move yourself around a lot.
So that's why you're behind the couch.
That's, you know, Freud said he didn't like the idea of people looking at him for 8 hours a day. I think he was just being sort of sarcastic in a mild way. Not that. It really is to allow yourself to be fully part of the patient's associations. And many of my patients, almost all of them, who are not in analysis, are on the couch about 30% of the time. I give people the option to lie on the couch. When they do that, when they want to say something to me that embarrasses them,
they
want me looking at them.
Yeah, that's when I jump on the couch too. I go, this is hard, you know.
And that's exactly it. Yeah. So, you know, that's psychoanalysis, and And the stuff we're talking about is applying analytic ideas to serious community problems. And, you know, frankly, if the other methods of doing it had been successful, I wouldn't be worrying about it. But we've tried, you know, punishing people. We now have more people in prisons in the United States than we have at universities. We're starting to let people go from prison long before they fill their sentence because we don't have room to have them. So nonviolent felonies, and I think California freed 9,000 nonviolent felony prisoners because they had not enough room in prisons to hold the bodies. You see, so the punishment surveillance idea is a failure.
It's ridiculous. It's just insane. It's just so top down. I mean, I can understand locking somebody up if they're like really dangerous or if they won't control themselves, but.
Yeah. My guess is this country, which has just under 320 million people, I think it has about 317 million, needs 1,000-bed maximum security prison.
Yes.
For the whole country. And the only people that need to be in it, and they'll tell you, don't let me in. I can't control myself.
They will tell you.
One guy who was paroled as a child serial killer and rapist, he said, don't let me out. And they let him out because he'd finished his sentence. And they got him back 10 days later, 7 bodies.
Uh-huh.
And he said, don't let me out. Well, there are a small number of people, I'd say about 1,000 in 317 million, who should never be out in the community. I'm not in favor of killing them. To me, that really is a sort of crude way of handling the problem.
Yeah, I agree. I always say I want Heroin Island or Pedophile Island or, you know, just some place for them where they just can't annoy us. Alcatraz is a bit harsh, but...
My friends support the death penalty, Jill. They think we should execute them, then it wouldn't cost anything because... It costs $75,000 to $100,000 a year to keep somebody in a prison. That's a lot of money for the taxpayer to pay.
It is a lot of money. Stephen wants us to wind up, so we better go back somewhere. Is Stephen, are you there?
Yes, I am.
I think you should join us for the last minute.
Oh, you guys are doing fine. I don't think people should be put to death either, but, you know, what are you going to do with these people that really can't be rehabilitated?
That's where I think, Stephen, there's a place for one prison in the whole of America. I think that's all you would need. Maximum security prison, 1,000 beds.
And that's altruism.
That really is. You're protecting people who tell you, I should not ever be in the normal population. I will kill people.
Yeah.
And then some of these guys, a big percentage of them, will tell you they feel better and safer and more comfortable in a prison setting.
Sure they do.
And actually having been in prison would give them the opportunity to realize that it is a relief to them.
It is.
To be,
who are lifers like that, they actually become quite altruistic. I've got an account of one multiple murderer, serial killer, who heads a very well-known program to rehab prisoners who are going to get out after 15 or 20 years. His work is amazing. It's what he does as part of his prison work.
But when somebody's in the cycle of harming, then you don't have the gap to be able to see. Yes, Stephen.
If you just want to wrap up, we can talk afterwards.
Okay. All right. So... that's been really interesting. This diagram will be on with this podcast, won't it, Stephen?
Yes, it will.
It's going to live there permanently.
Yes.
And Stuart, you're going to be giving a talk this weekend somewhere, aren't you?
Yes, I'm giving a talk in New York City along with Vamik Volkan, who is an absolutely remarkable figure we should talk about him sometime. He's a Turkish Cypriot who... is a psychoanalytic diplomat. He did psychotherapy with the Presidium members in Moscow during the collapse of the Soviet Union. He was called there to help them out. He was involved in the very first Arab-Israeli treaty. and he's been just about to every major political issue in the world. The other is Peter Fonagy, who is a psychoanalyst from London, who works with attachment and with the health of very young children and how very young children think. And we're going to talk, and me, we're going to talk about gun violence.
Fantastic. Stuart Twemlow and Stephen Roberts and April Rain, but particularly Stuart Twemlow, thank you very much.